Let's talk about the Bible and women. So the very first thing I should just say out of the gate in our modern sensitive times is that I'm not a woman. Nor am I planning on transitioning to be a woman. So some might wonder what possible things I might have to say about women in the Bible. And I concede that there's a perspective that I do lack, not being a woman. So I acknowledge the difficulty. I'm putting it out there. And hopefully the biblical narrative will provide us the guidance that we need to talk about this topic, even from the lips of a man. But I mean, I think this is an important topic because when we talk about engaging the culture, I think increasingly the more we move into sort of identity politics and sort of the culture of offense, and there's an increasing stumbling block for Christians that really hasn't been one for most of our history, even in the West. And that's the charge that the Bible is fundamentally misogynistic, that it hates women and that it empowers patriarchy and that it keeps women down. And some of the, you know, I remember when I was in seminary, I did my first exegesis paper. I don't know what I was thinking doing this, but I picked the story about the concubine of the Levite in Judges 19, how he like chops her up into 12 pieces and sends her by the 12 tribes of Israel. And I remember in sort of doing due diligence and like exegeting the passage, I picked up some feminist interpreters. And one of the books I remember quite clearly was Phyllis Tribble's Texts of Terror, Literary Feminist Readings of Biblical Narratives. And of course, she had a whole chapter on Judges 19 because it's a pretty, you don't have to be a woman to appreciate that Judges 19 is pretty awful. Of course, I argued in my paper that's the point. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes in those days without a king in Israel, and it was pretty bad. So, sort of taking our cue from scholars like Phyllis Tribble, some of the objections that are lobbied against the Bible, of course, is the Old Testament laws treat women as property. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife or his ass or his ox. Like, is she in the same league? One of the laws is often cited as evidence of the Old Testament laws just barbarity towards women. Is the requirement that a man who rapes a woman has to take her as his wife. And that seems like, look at this, you know, this, all a man has to do is just rape a woman and then he's got her. I mean, it's clear the Bible hates women. Women are often depicted in the book of Proverbs, for example, as like the archetypal seductress who like lures the righteous man away from the path. So clearly the Old Testament has an axe to grind against women. Another argument that's made is that Paul hates women. He talks about how they must be silent in the church. They must be submissive to their husbands. He does not permit a woman to speak. Clearly, Paul, the apostle, hates women. And then, of course, the biblical Christianity as such is often a cover for domestic abuse, that pastors, when advising women in abusive relationships, just tell them that they're participating in the sufferings of Christ and that they have to love and honor their husbands no matter what he does to them, and encouraging women to stay in situations that are very, very dangerous. And you see, like, even if some of these charges have some merit to them and need to be wrestled with, we're getting to a point of like popular perception, like The Handmaid's Tale, where it depicts like this is what happens when the Bible is let loose in cultures, that men have all these concubines. And it's like, except for the fact that that's never once happened in the history of Christianity. Like that's never, the biblical revelation hasn't permitted Christian men during the age of the fall of Rome to treat women in that way, as a matter of course. So it's this grotesquely distorted understanding of what the Bible and what biblical Christianity does to women. It's not actually based on any serious engagement with what the Bible and Christianity has, in fact, historically done to women or provided for women. And so, you know, The Handmaid's Tale, you guys are familiar with The Handmaid's Tale, that HBO miniseries that depicts a sort of a post-apocalyptic America where, like, elite men have multiple wives. The fundamental premise is that this is a theocracy, that these men are all Christians and that they've taken over America after some event that destroyed civilization, and they've imposed this sort of rigid Bible reading on the rest of the country, and this is what's produced, because that's never actually happened in the history of the church. So I don't know why it would all of a sudden. Of course, with all these examples, context is king. When you compare the Old Testament laws to modern law, perhaps, it may look a bit harsh in some spheres. But when you compare Old Testament law with some of the surrounding law codes of the same period, from, say, Egypt or Babylon, we actually see that the Bible's treatment of women is rather progressive, rather humane. And so, for example, women are provided greater degrees of protection in the Old Testament law than they are in other laws of the period. So for example, let's just take that strange rape law that I mentioned before. Rather than being a punishment for the woman who's forced to live with her rapists, the law actually has in mind the provision of women, because in this culture, again, women are dependent on the males of their family to protect and provide for them. And so that if a man rapes a woman, she becomes, in some sense, in this kind of culture, ineligible for marriage. Who's going to provide for her? Well, the man who has robbed her of this status of virgin is responsible now for taking care of her. Like, he has to take on the burden, if he's going to take this woman's sexuality, of providing for her the way any husband would. And so it seems harsh from our point of view, but actually from the Old Testament law's point of view, it's designed to protect vulnerable women. Another example is how when men and women are taken in adultery, both the men and the women suffer the same penalty if they are found guilty. That's not the case in other law codes of the period. Often the women would just be stoned to death or whatever for violating her marriage vows. And this is in fact part of how you understand that story in John 8, where they present this woman to Jesus. He's, whoever's free of sin, cast the first stone, sort of calling them to legal account for the fact that, well, where's the guy? If you caught her in adultery, then where's the guy? The law of Moses specifies that he needs to be here facing the judicial panel as well. It can't just be the woman. So they're violating the law of Moses themselves by trying to corner Jesus. And so again, you see that there's actually protection for women in the Old Testament law when you compare it to the culture around the ancient Israelites. Let's look at the issue of the Proverbs contrasting or holding up women as sort of the archetypal seductress. Well, if we're going to look at that, then we need to pay attention to the fact that Proverbs also exalts a woman as the divine wisdom. Wisdom in both Hebrew and Greek is a feminine word. And so it's the woman of harlotry in Proverbs is contrasted with the woman of wisdom in the book of Proverbs. And of course, the book ends with the wife of noble character. And so it's not just that, see, women are seductresses and many to avoid them. It's contrasting two different kinds of women, one who's a seductress and one who's a wife of noble character. And so the Bible seems to recognize both and give honor, especially to the latter. And of course, it's worth mentioning, just looking at the list of the things the wife of noble character is describing of doing, it sort of belies the notion that the biblical conception of women is that they're just stuck at home all day tending the washing machine, the vacuum cleaner. Like, the woman in Proverbs 31 is buying and selling property and engaging in sales in the marketplace. And it's the center of a major economic production unit in her household. And so she's not idle. If anything, that conception of women staying at home is the result of the Industrial Revolution, when people are increasingly working away from their homes. And so I think the Bible encourages us to think more critically about women in the modern workforce than perhaps you might think. And then, of course, you say nothing of the prophets. The prophets, again, often hold up Israel as an adulteress. You know, here's the seductress women, here's adulteress. But Israel as an adulteress is contrasted in the prophets as Israel, the spotless bride that God goes out into the desert to woo and to win to himself. And so, again, you see a virtuous woman also held up as a standard in the Old Testament. Let's look at Paul. Paul hates women. Does he really? Actually, again, if you compare Paul to his ancient Roman context, he overthrows quite a lot of ancient notions. For example, when he talks about how the husband owned the wife's body, that wouldn't have been surprising to anybody back in Roman days. But then when he goes on to say, and also, by the way, the wives own the husband's body as well, so that neither one of them can deprive each other of their conjugal rights as a couple. And so the idea that the wife would own the husband's body is radically countercultural and undermines some conceptions about the way women relate to men. It's really a great equalizer. And it's often used that way by the church fathers, who are often accused of being misogynists themselves. John Chrysostom, for example, takes great stock in the phrase, the Paul, about women owning their husbands' bodies, to encourage men to be faithful to their marital responsibilities to their wives. The Puritans, likewise, provided laws for women to take their husbands to court if they were denying them their conjugal rights as wives. And we actually have some examples of the Puritans in New England doing this. We think of the Puritans as prudes. They'll surprise you sometimes. The command of silence, for example, in the Old Testament, or in the epistles of Paul, is tempered by Paul's explicit permission for women to prophesy. And we might question what that means. What does prophecy mean in the modern context? But it certainly means, at the very least, that there is a context in which Paul envisions women speaking in the church. So that helps us understand what he might mean by women being silent and bringing their husbands to their questions to their husbands after the service is over. And of course, we'll look at it in a moment about what Paul says about women submitting to their husbands, because it's tempered by a pretty crucial counter command of the man that makes it possible. And we'll get to that in a second. Indeed, in the aggregate, in the Bible, women are often depicted as foils of righteousness against faithless men. So when the men of Israel are faithful, it's often women who rise up and bring about righteous conclusions. We think about Tamar and Judah. Judah's depriving this widowed woman of her rights. And so she tricks him, and Judah recognizes that she's the righteous one. Deborah laments that there are no men that are faithful enough from God's point of view to be raised up as judges, so God's raised up her. She acknowledges that she ought to be, the role that she's fulfilling ought to be that of a man, but that men aren't doing it, so God raised up Deborah. Hannah and Eli, we'll look at Hannah next week, but you know, Eli thinks she's drunk when she's crying out to God, and she holds fast, and God vindicates her. Abigail and David, we saw that a couple weeks ago, how David was about to get his hands dirty, and by God's action through Abigail, he spares David that. So Abigail, again, the righteous person, saving David from himself. And then, of course, in the Gospels, you can contrast Mary's response to the angelic visit that she will give birth to a son to Zechariah's response when the angel tells him that his wife, Elizabeth, will give birth to a son. Zechariah doesn't believe, and so the angel makes him mute for the whole pregnancy, which I imagine would make many wives in this congregation happy if the angels would do that. Again, we're seeing that the response of a woman is contrasted in the narrative itself with the response of a man to the exact same scenario. And the woman's response is, I am the handmaid of the Lord. May it be to me according to thy word. In the New Testament, women play a massive role. We are told in the Gospels that women are primarily responsible for bankrolling Jesus' ministry. He's an itinerant priest or itinerant preacher. How's he feeding himself? How's he feeding his disciples? Well, it turns out he had some patrons who were women that funded his ministry. Jesus, in fact, of Jewish rabbis of that day, permits unprecedented access to himself by women, that they can be his disciples, that he rebukes Martha because she's mad at Mary for sitting at Jesus' feet. Well, the posture of sitting at the feet of a rabbi is the posture of a disciple. And Jesus is permitting Mary that privilege and that honor. Women, you know, when all the disciples flee Jesus during his moments of crisis, who is it that follows him all the way to Calvary but the women, including his own mother, who had followed him since the beginning? It is women who stay true to him when everybody else runs away, including his own disciples, including Peter, as women who are at his side at the cross. And it is women, interestingly, who are the first witnesses of the resurrection. And this is all the more remarkable when you consider the fact that even in Jewish law at that time, women were not permitted to give legally binding testimony in a court. And so the fact that Jesus would have these women be the first witnesses of his resurrection, the fact that he would send angels to them to tell them, go tell the disciples that he's not here, that he's risen, he's enlisting them as witnesses, legal witnesses of his resurrection. Without the women at the tomb on the first Easter morning, we'd know nothing about it. I mean, they're the first to notice. The disciples are all pouting somewhere because it's all over. And it's women who go and honor Jesus in his death and then discover that God has raised him to life. Women are some of the patrons, some of the most important patrons of the earliest Gentile churches. In fact, the first convert in Europe is Lydia, a woman that Paul honors Priscilla, calling her esteemed among the apostles. And in fact, he seems to even call her a deacon. He calls her deacon. It's often translated in English Bibles as a servant of the Lord. The form of the Greek word there is actually the masculine form, which seems to suggest that Paul is using it in a technical sense, that she actually is an officer of the church. She's a deacon. That's in Romans 16. And of course, speaking of Romans 16, just look at Paul's honor roll of the faith in that chapter of the Bible. How many women are included in his list of people for whom he's very thankful? People who have sacrificed greatly for him and for the ministry. I'm not sure it's fair to say that Paul hates women, or that the New Testament paints them badly. And I think, again, let's just coming back now to this idea that the Bible is responsible for the oppression of women. And there's no question that some men have definitely used the Bible's exhortation for women to submit to their husbands as a pretense for abuse. I think that does happen. And churches sometimes are guilty in keeping women in dangerous situations when they should be trying to come to their aid. Paul contrasts the husband's the woman's duty to submit to her husband in Ephesians 5 with husbands loving their wives as Christ loved the church
and gave himself up for her to present her pure and spotless. In fact, that comes first. And I think that the sequence is significant. Women can't be honestly asked to submit to their husbands if their husbands don't provide a ground for them to submit by sacrificing their own self-interests for their wives. Just as Christ sacrificed his own interest, did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself and took the form of a servant to the point of death so that he could present the bride pure and spotless to himself. Right, so the model here in the marriage relationship is of self-sacrifice. And it's a self-sacrifice of Christ that allows faith in the church to even occur, and that our response of submission to him is in response to his service to us. We owe him honor as God and Lord of all, whether he serves us or not, right? The fact that he serves us first anyway, the fact that he loves us when we did not love him, when we were his enemies, this is the paradigm. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, submit to your husbands as in the Lord. And so we need to see this as a reciprocal relationship, and that even from the male side point of view, the ability to lay down his life for his wife is predicated on the fact, on the premise of whether or not he knows that she's got his back. You know, husbands nagging their wives, nagging their husbands, and emasculate them is also a thing that happens. And how much easier is it for the man to deny his own self-interest for his wife when he knows that his wife will submit to him in it? So it goes both ways. And the church has a responsibility in marriage relationships to see that both are doing their part, because they both need each other, according to Paul's own command. You know, so this is just sort of a quick rundown of how the Bible talks about women. And I think it's a vast oversimplification, and it's unfair to just throw out the Bible as misogynistic. When we see the way it actually extols and honors women in the narrative, both Old and New Testament, how that witness contrasts with the way other ancient documents from the time periods speak about women. The Bible is, in fact, a wonderfully liberating document. And it's been documented by sociologists of religion and historians that women converted in large numbers to Christian faith in the early centuries of the church because the church provided them access to what we might now call upward mobility, that in the life of the church, they actually had a voice. And so we see large numbers of women converting to the faith in the early church. And this is corroborated by the testimony of the church fathers, you know, the early church fathers. Just read about the martyrdom of Perpetua and Felicity and the honor that's being heaped on these women who are confessing faith in Jesus to the bitter end. So, has the church sometimes failed women? Yes, I think that we have. We need to be mindful about what the Bible's whole witness about women actually is, rather than just focusing on women as a seductress in early books, the chapters of Proverbs, or women submitting to their husbands in Ephesians 5. Seeing them also as foils against the unrighteousness and faithlessness of men in both testaments. Seeing them as the first those who remained faithful to Jesus to the bitter end, even when his disciples all fled and ran away. The first witnesses of the resurrection. We need to be mindful of the whole counsel of God and not just parts of it that we like. All of it. And it has a lot of things to say about women of noble character. And in this church, we are part of a diocese that believes in a traditional order. We do not admit women to the order of priests in our diocese. We believe that is apostolic custom. We believe that there's something inherent in male and female, that God does want men to be the elders in his church. But we do need to find ways, even within traditional order, to give women the power and the voice that they need to use the gifts that God has given them in Christ and to allow them to practice the ministry that they have, like all disciples have, to proclaim the good news of Jesus. In our diocese, we do permit women to serve as deacons. We don't have one at this church, but there would be no canonical reason why we couldn't. I think that we need to be creative, even if we do submit to traditional order about male headship in the church. Again, seeing headship in those terms of self-sacrifice, which in some sense is a calling on men, to find ways to empower women to do the work of the ministry, just like all the rest of the saints of God. So I have that as a pretty important sort of, forgive me for preaching to you, but kind of an important caveat before we dive into our study of women in the Bible. Because I think the narratives that we're going to look at are part of this trajectory in the scriptures of women who are showing heroic faith in the face of structures and men who don't believe in them, don't think they're worth much, just think they get drunk and sort of fall down in hysterics in the tabernacle courts because that's what women do. She's drunk. Get her out of here. On the contrary, Hannah puts Eli in his place, or rather God puts Eli in his place through Hannah, to Eli's credit, He owns that and says, you are more righteous than I. So I put that out there. Provocative, maybe, perhaps. I don't think we talk about this issue very well in the church. I don't think we talk about husbands and wives loving and submitting to one another very well in the church. We tend to be very polarized about it. And I don't see this middle wave. Yeah, husbands, wives should submit, but husbands should lay down their lives. I don't often see that. And I don't understand why. I mean, it's the scripture we're talking about here. It's not like I'm reading into it. That's what Paul says. He has a lot more to say about the man's responsibilities than he does about the woman's in that particular passage. So anyway, I'd put it to you guys. Push back on me. Let me know if this is rubbing you the wrong way, and we can talk about it. Leah's over here like, absolutely not, baby. Any thoughts about that? Nobody's here. Maybe God's judging me by not sending anybody to come to church. I don't know. The remnants here? What am I talking about? Indeed. Indeed. Okay. I'm happy to go into more depth with it if anybody they want to. One thing I accidentally skipped, go back to Genesis. I love Genesis 5 and Genesis 1 and Ephesians 5, or Genesis 2 rather, and Ephesians 5. When God creates the woman, it's a great gift to the man. He's alone. And it's the only time in the entire creation narrative when God said, it is not good. You know, days 1 through 6, it is good, it is good, it is good, it is very good. Man's alone, it is not good. He gives the woman the man, he gives the woman to the man, takes her from his side. Even the ancient church fathers saw significance in the fact that she's from his side and not from his feet or from his head, that there's equality there in some mysterious way. And then if you look at the Genesis narrative, it's interesting how the man erupts in song. It's the first praise song of the entire Bible. It's a woman heaping praise on God for this gift of a woman. Interesting how the man changes his tune in Genesis 3. This woman that you gave me, she... once again, man abdicating their responsibility to lay down their lives for their wives. Right there in Genesis 3. But it's interesting, the man says that for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. In ancient Hebrew culture, it was always the woman who left her father's household and entered into her husband's father's household. It was never the reverse. And so the fact that the Hebrew culture, where that was the norm, would write that for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. Again, it's that sacramental image of the man, behold the man, Jesus Christ the righteous, leaving his father's household in heaven and holding fast to his wife in the mires of sin and death here on earth in order to present him to himself pure and spotless. Even in Genesis 2, there's this precursor of the man laying down his life, the man leaving his father's household and all that's comfortable and familiar to him for the sake of cleaving to his wife. So again, we need to take stock of the whole narrative and not just the passages that we like. And all from Genesis chapter 2 all the way to the end. It's a fairly constant witness. The present series, we're going to be looking at some women in the scripture. We're going to be looking at women who I think are sort of held up as sort of miraculous examples, heroic examples of faith in the face of great statistical unlikeliness. We're going to look at Rahab today. We're going to look at Hannah, who's the mother of Samuel. Next week, and then we're going to spend Holy Week. We'll be off, because please don't ask me to teach a class during Holy Week. It's not going to happen. But the Wednesday after Easter, we will conclude the series by looking at Mary, the Mother of the Lord, and what she has to teach us. I was joking with somebody today that when we talk about Mary, we're going to talk about her Immaculate Conception and her assumption into heaven to be crowned by her son and how she's mediatrix. No, we're not going to talk about any of those things. We don't believe those things as Anglicans. We believe we're going to stick close to the biblical texts. The scriptures do honor Mary as a very faithful woman. She plays a pivotal role in the history of salvation as being the mother of our Lord. But we're gonna stick to the biblical texts and not go beyond it. We have to kind of do it piecemeal like this. I've been doing one figure a month for the rest of the series. Paul gets a whole month after this because we don't have a whole lot of full narratives of women in the Bible. You know, we've got two whole books about David. We've got lots of letters by Paul. You might see this as evidence that maybe the Bible is misogynistic after all. I mean, all these men get full narratives and women don't get hardly any. Well, wait, we do have some women in the Bible that get whole narratives. We've got Ruth and we've got Esther. Two whole books of the Bible about the faithfulness of women. Are you telling me to stop? Oh, maybe he is. I've decided not to go into depth about Esther and Ruth just because I feel like we talk about them in Sunday school, and you know, you can read their stories, and I did kind of want to focus on these smaller stories that I think are actually part of the Bible's own subversive narrative of holding up these small anecdotes, and a lot of them, of women who are very faithful, and sometimes in the face of faithlessness of men. So I kind of wanted to call your attention to the way, even with these small little vignettes that we have, the Bible does in fact do that. And we turn now to Rahab, who's a great example of this principle. Any questions about the series moving forward? Who are some of your favorite women in the Bible? You like Gomer? I asked my wife that, and she said she likes Tamar, the woman who seduces Judah. She's like, that took guts, man. That's some tenacity right there. Like, if you know my wife at all, it makes complete sense why she would be attracted to Tamar for that reason. She's also a tenacious person. There's a debate in our household about who pursued who early in our relationship. She let me think I was the one doing it, but I think I was actually the victim. She came after me. I was the prey. I don't mind. Worked out okay for me. Anyway, what do you guys think? What are some of your... Do you have a favorite woman in the Bible, Casey? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure. It certainly takes some chutzpah to just complain to Jesus, right? Like, Jesus, make her work. Like, you go, girl. You tell that Messiah what's up. Yeah, okay. Martha, what else? Any other? Wendy, do you have a yeah, Rebecca.
The story of Ruth, and you mentioned a really unusual story
that
here's a foreigner.
Right, she's a Moabitess. Oh, yeah, don't spoil it. Huh?
Yes.
Dave, do you have a favorite woman in the Bible?
Oh.
In this church, we don't play those games, man. A man is allowed to talk. The flip side of Martha, or?
No, the mother of Jesus.
Oh, Mary, okay.
The girl got a bad rap in evangelical Christianity.
Sure. And sort of overreaction to Roman extremes. Yeah.
She was a young girl and she couldn't have been ignorant of the consequences.
Sure.
And she simply said, whatever you want.
Yeah.
And
how God provided for her, right? I mean, sort of letting Joseph in on it.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no reason why he had to do that, but he did.
Amazing.
Yeah. Of course, Joseph is faithful in that narrative too. Let's not miss that point. Even as we rightly honor the mother of our Lord. Jan, do you have a favorite woman in the Bible?
I was going
to say
the two
Marys.
Yeah?
Yeah, right. Talk about a life transformed, right? By the Lord's presence. Okay. Let's look at Rahab real quick. Rahab's story is recorded in Joshua 2 and Joshua 6. But interestingly enough, she also gets 3 shout-outs in the New Testament, which, by the way, is more than Esther. She's included in the lineage of the Lord in Matthew 1:5, one of a few women who are sort of singled out in the lineage. It's the male line, but every once in a while it says who the wife was, and she's one of them. Hebrews 11:31, her faith is extolled in the roll call of faith, that famous chapter from Hebrews 11. And then James 2:25, he holds up Rahab as an example of how true faith makes itself known by good works. So we kind of see in Hebrews that the faith that saves, and on the flip side of the coin, James, genuine faith may save alone, but it's never by itself. It's never actually alone. It always brings on its heels good works. And we see that in the way that Rahab believed in Israel's God, but then acted on it and protected Israel's, these two spies. The conquest of the context of Rahab is, of course, the conquest of Canaan. Israel's command to completely destroy the inhabitants of Canaan. And I think it's important that we take stock of this fact when we look at Rahab and how miraculous her role in the story is. Because there are few people in the scriptures that get God's ire than the Canaanites. In fact, I think the only people in the entire Bible that get God's ire more than the Canaanites are the Israelites, interestingly enough. And in fact, he tells them that if they behave the way the Canaanites behave, that he will, the land will vomit them out, just as it vomited out the Canaanites before them. And you might say, why does God so loathe the Canaanites? Why this command to utterly destroy them? Keep in mind that the provisions for holy war in the law of Moses were very limited in their scope. Israel wasn't allowed to just engage in holy war on whoever they wanted. It was only against the peoples in Canaan whose land God had promised them. Israel had a whole separate set of law codes in Leviticus and Deuteronomy that governed how they conducted war with other nations, and it was much more restrained. So the provisions for holy war were not just indiscriminate. Israel, whenever you engage war, this is how it works. It's only applied to the way God calls them to fight the Canaanites in the Holy Land. And if you want more thoughts on that, I gave a whole lecture last year in our series on the history of salvation, Walking Through the Bible. I spent a whole Wednesday night talking about the conquest narratives and the concept of holy war in the Bible. So you can go listen to that if you want to learn more. Suffice it to say, in this context, God is fed up with the Canaanites and is bringing down judgment upon them because their practices are particularly detestable to him. And one practice that they engage in that God singles out on a few occasions as evidence of their detestable sort of, they're handed over into detestable practices is the fact that they sacrifice their children. And when Israel is shown in the age of the kings as falling away into unrighteousness, one of the examples of them doing that is when one of the kings of Israel sacrifices his own sons. And this is a king in the line of David, so he's sacrificing the messianic line to Molech, which really pissed God off. God is not at all a fan of the way the Canaanites sacrifice their children. We actually have the archaeological remains of little Molech shrines from Canaan that date to the period before Israel's conquest, where you'd have a fire pit and like a little like slide that you would like slide the infants into the mouth of Molech, which was sort of a mouth of an oven. Horrible, horrible practice. God hates it. God condemns it in no uncertain terms in the law of Moses. And he cites that particular practice among a few others, but that particular practice for why Israel is justified in being God's instrument in utterly destroying these people. And so the Canaanites are not just any old run-of-the-mill enemies of Israel, like the Philistines or the Moabites, who aren't included under the precincts of holy war because they're not in land God promised Israelites. These people are done for. God calls Israel to utterly exterminate them. Israel has been making its way from Egypt now for a while, 40 years, as they've been coming. So they rather than coming directly north into the Holy Land, they went east first and came up north into what's called the Transjordan, the modern country of Jordan. And then while they were there, they engaged a couple of kings and said, grant us safe passage. Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan. And both guys freaked out of their minds about what God's going to do with these people because they've heard news about what God did to the Egyptians through them. They're like, you can't pass through our land. And Israel's like, no, please, we promise we'll stay on the narrow path. We won't deviate to the right or the left. We'll just make our way right through, and you won't have to worry about us ever again. And they resisted. They marshaled their armies against the armies of Israel. And so God's like, take them out. So then that territory becomes part of the tribal allotment. The Transjordan becomes part of the Holy Land when they conquer these kings. And a couple of the tribes settle there. Now Israel's crossed the Jordan. And the first major fortified city that meets them when they enter into the Holy Land is the city of Jericho. It's right there, right next to the Jordan River. If they're going to make any forward progress into the highlands of Judah or beyond, into the plain beyond and close to the coast, they have to take out Jericho. It is the way station moving east-west over the Jordan. So it's the first fortified city that they get to. And so it's the first real test of God's promise that he'll give this land over to them. Because here you have this ragtag group of herders, kind of mobile, against this fortified city. Will God be faithful? And boy, is he. So now, that's the context. Turning to Joshua chapter 2. Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, go and view the land, especially Jericho. Again, Jericho is the way station. It's the gateway to the rest of the promised land. It has to be in their hands if they're going to be successful in the rest of the conquest. And they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there. So in the Hebrew, it's being a little cagey with us here. It's being a little cheeky. This word for lodged is actually the word Hebrew word shavav, which just means to lie down. They went to the house of a prostitute, and they laid there. Ooh, spice. I think the text is being deliberately ironic, because the text goes out of its way to indicate that the spies did not, in fact, engage in any solicitous activity in the house of Rahab the prostitute, which has provoked some scholars, including some scholars from the ancient church, to suggest that this word prostitute here may not be entirely descriptive of Rahab's position. The Hebrew word zona does usually apply to prostitutes, women of harlotry. The word in the Greek translation of the Old Testament is the word from which we get the word pornography. It's pornēs, a woman of pornēs. So probably it's one thing that she does, but the fact that the spies have come into their house suggests that that's not the only service that she provides. It's not entirely uncommon in this period, as in other periods of human history, for inns or taverns to also be places where other services would be rendered. Yeah, yeah. Right. So these guys are probably going into this place just to stay the night, just to like literally lay down, to go to sleep. But the fact that this woman is a prostitute, I think the narrative tells us that. And I think that's designed to heighten the irony of the narrative. The Canaanites are bad. God calls Israel to exterminate them. They practice cult prostitution. They practice child sacrifice. And here we go, like prime example, exhibit A, example number one, Rahab the prostitute. Like, what do you expect when you meet Canaanites but to meet a bunch of prostitutes, right? It's designed, I think, to heighten the contrast of what actually transpires. And it was told the king of Jericho, "Behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." And then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men," blah, blah, blah. In other words, these spies of Israel are really bad at spying. Doesn't take very much for them to be completely found out, completely exposed. King found out, knew immediately where they were. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, "True, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them with stalks of flax that she had laid out on the roof. You'd often lay out flax to dry on the roof of houses that were flat roofs. So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords, and the gate was shut as soon as the pursuers had gone out. All right, first question number one. Rahab is extolled throughout the biblical narrative as a righteous woman. And here we see her righteousness being secured by a falsehood, a deception, a bald-faced lie. I didn't know where they came from. I mean, but they left already. I mean, I don't know where they came from. What do we do with that? Any thoughts about this contrast? Anybody? Was she wrong to lie? Might there have been other means at her disposal to like hide the spies and not give them away without lying? Potentially.
Well, it might have been easier to just fess up and say, yeah, but they were there. Because then the news wasn't false to the king, but at the same time.
Well, sort of. She says that she didn't know where they came from, and she does, and that they left, and she knows that's not true. So maybe that first detail is not a lie, but...
Well, that's what I mean. Like, yeah. You start with what the report was, and then...
It's sort of a moral tale on how lies become bigger and bigger. The webs we weave, and first we practice to deceive. There's a story from the ancient church when Athanasius, the bishop of Alexandria, he's exiled from his see 5 times for confessing the true faith. And I think the 4th time, he's being pursued down the Nile River by imperial agents. and they catch up to him, and they're on boats, right? So they're in the river, and of course this is an age before photography, so they don't actually know what Athanasius looks like. They just know they're after him. So they catch up to the boat Athanasius is in. They're like right behind him, and they shout up forward to Athanasius, like, "Have you seen the Bishop Athanasius?" And Athanasius says, "Yes, he is right in front of you, and you hurry, you will catch him." And they said, "Thanks," and sped right on by. It wasn't a lie. He told the truth. He was right in front of him. If they hurried, they would have caught him. They misinterpreted what he said. Not quite what we have here. She tells a lie. Huh? Their mistake. And so with the spies, presumably. Yeah. She really is, isn't she? I mean, this is her hometown. I mean, everybody knows her, presumably. I mean, the Bible uses the language of city, but ancient cities weren't that large. We're talking smaller than Hillsdale, a couple thousand people, maybe. People tend to know each other in communities that size. So her reputation's on the line, such as it is as a prostitute. Her relationships in the community are on the line. Her life's on the line. What if the king finds out? What if he searches the house? What if he looks under the stalks of flax on the roof? They buy it. Verse 8, "Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, 'I know that the Lord is giving you the land.'" Notice how she refers to God here. According to the narrative, the name Yahweh, from which we derive the word Lord, it's capitalized here, but it's the word Yahweh in Hebrew, derives from the covenant name of God that God only first revealed to the human race. When did God first reveal his name as I am that I am? Nope. It's Moses, burning bush. Who should I say sent me to them? Tell them I am sent them. Yahweh actually is the third person version of the verb. God says I am. Yahweh means he is. He says, "I am." We say, "He is." That's the name. So she's referring to God by his covenant name, which has been revealed to the Israelites. "I know that Yahweh is giving you this land." She sees the writing on the wall, "And that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you, for we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who are bound beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction." That phrase in the English, "devoted to destruction," is that technical Hebrew word, cherem, which is holy war, utter consecration, i.e. burning. So that's how they're rendering it in the English here. In fact, there's a footnote here that it even says that. That is, set apart, devoted, as an offering to the Lord for destruction. It's just one word in Hebrew, that you cheremed. "And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath." What a remarkable statement of faith. I mean, she basically admits that everybody else around her is terrified stiff and can't do anything but just shut their doors and like hope that doesn't happen to them, right? And she's putting herself in that in with them, like, "We heard, and our hearts melted." Like, she's identifying herself as a Canaanite with the other Canaanites. And here she's seeing what's going on. Her eyes are open, and she's like, "I got to get with this guy, because clearly he's where it's at." That's what she says next. "Now then, please, swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, also will deal kindly with my father's house, and give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father, my mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." And the men said to her, "Our life is yours, even to death. If you do not tell this business of ours, then when the Lord gives us the land, we will deal kindly and faithfully with you." So she asks, she swears by Israel's God that they would save her. What do we learn about saving faith from this point, from Rahab's confession of faith? Of what does it consist, you might say? Just put yourself in her shoes. This is her hometown. These are her home people. This is her home culture. This is not the God she was raised to worship. She'd never heard of him, of course, before she'd heard of the Israelites. Sure. I mean, she's afraid, but she's not quite afraid in the same way that everybody else is afraid, are they?
She's willing to die for it.
Sir? What makes you say that?
Because she's hiding criminals to the...
Sure. So there was a huge risk of getting caught that she took. Mm-hmm. So she put her life on the line.
But I think she probably wants to die anyway.
Possibly. She seems to see that's what's coming. That spare my life, because I know you're not going to spare anybody else's. She's seen what they've done to Sihon and Og. Total destruction. Take no prisoners.
Yeah, but it's a proper understanding of who God is, what he's capable of, and she offers herself to him.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Total self-abandonment. He can have me. Just swear by him that you'll, because I've helped you, that you'll let me live. It's quite bold on her part. No one else is doing this. She's the only one in the whole city. And, you know, at this point, it's kind of what's going to happen. God's told the Israelites to kill all the Canaanites. So is she going to get a pass? Doesn't she qualify as a Canaanite? And here she's a prostitute, for crying out loud. She's engaging in that very cult prostitution that God says he hates. What's going to happen? Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was built into the city wall. There's another ominous sign, right? I mean, we know what happens to the walls of Jericho, don't we? So that she lived in the wall. And she said to them, go into the hills, or the pursuers will encounter you, and hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Then afterward you may go your way. The men said to her, so she gives them more advice. We will be guiltless with respect to this oath of yours that you have made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, you shall tie this scarlet cord into the window through which you have let us down, and you shall gather into your house your father and mother, your brothers, and all your father's household. Then if anyone goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we shall be guiltless. But if a hand is laid on anyone who is with you in the house, his blood will be on our head. But if you tell this business of ours, then we shall be guiltless with respect to your oath that you have made us swear. And she said, according to your word, so be it. Then she sent them away, and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. Okay, what are the conditions for her survival? She really can't say anything, number one. At this point, she's now guilty of harboring spies, so she probably would be killed by her own king if she said anything anyway. What else? Stay in the house. Gather her family, who also must stay in the house. And display the scarlet cord. Does this sound at all familiar? Passover. What are some of the common elements, David? Sure. It's not blood in this case, but it is scarlet. I think anyone in the Bible gives us details like that is trying to tell us something. You guys have heard that phrase, the scarlet cord, throughout the Testaments? I think it's an allusion to this passage. What else? What are the parallels with the Passover narrative? They have to stay indoors. And what happens if they go out in the Passover narrative? The angel strikes them down, right? So I'm wondering if there are some intentional allusions here to the Passover narrative and the way the Israelites are spared the Passover of the angel of the Lord by marking the doorposts with scarlet, with blood in this case, and that she also is to designate her household by scarlet, and that the household becomes a sanctum and she can't leave it. Even with the scarlet on the window, if anybody in her household leaves it, they forfeit their protection. Curious. And they departed, and the pursuers couldn't find them. Okay, fast forward now to chapter 6, verse 22 to 25. So Israel's now marched around Jericho 7 times. The walls have fallen down. The men have rushed up into the city. They've put it to the sword. But Joshua, in verse 22... But to the two men who had spied out the land, Joshua said, go into the prostitute's house and bring out from there the woman and all who belong to her, as you swore to her. So the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and brothers and all who belonged to her. And they brought all of her relatives and put them outside the camp of Israel. And they burned the city with fire and everything in it, only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron, they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. That's a sign that God's the conquering king in this case, and he gets the booty. That's one of the key stipulations of holy war, is that Israel doesn't get to keep any of it. It all goes to the treasury of God. But Rahab the prostitute and her father's household and all that belonged to her, Joshua saved alive. And she has lived in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Interesting that it's not just her, but God has mercy on her whole household. I mean, we have no knowledge whatsoever about their faith in Israel's God, but Rahab intercedes for them, and God saves them as a unit. This is a bit of a stretch, but I don't think it's entirely one. I think this provides a little bit of a basis for the idea of the family as a covenant unit, and it's why we sometimes see whole households being baptized in mass in the New Testament. Those passages don't say expressly that children are included in those numbers. But it's stories like this one that have been the grounds, among other arguments, for why it's permissible to baptize babies on the basis of their parents' faith. Because God does look to whole families as units, and that parents can speak for their children. This is even broader than that. This is her own parents and her own brothers and sisters and all of her relatives. So there might be some, maybe, mysterious biblical basis for the idea of... No, I did not. I did not. Of course, children die for their own sins, fathers die for their own sins. Within the Anglican tradition, when children come of age, they still are expected to make a statement of faith. It's not a freebie. We incorporate them as members of the community in Christ as children, and we treat them as such as we catechize them in the Lord. But they have an obligation to make this faith their own if they are to continue as adult members in the church when they come of age. So it's not as if that individual confession is therefore no longer relevant. It is. But there is some basis, I think, in the scriptures for this idea of sort of families as covenant units. Now, she said she lives in Israel to this day. Of course, it's not just that she lives in Israel. She, according to Matthew 1:5, is the mother of Boaz. And who is Boaz? It's Ruth's husband. So she's counted in the lineage of Christ as Boaz's mother. And that makes Rahab the Canaanite prostitute, the great-grandfather of King David, and therefore an ancestor of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. So here we have Canaanite blood in the lineage of the Messiah. Isn't that a remarkable thing? And what does that tell you, I think, about how God honors those who honor him? Let's tell you. Is there a limit? Is there a limit to who can be saved, perhaps? Even prostitutes? Prostitutes can be saved. What's required of them? They place their whole trust in the God of Israel. Right? Obviously, that's going to include action of some kind, as the book of James makes explicit. Her faith is shown forth in her action towards the spies. Obviously, God's going to call a prostitute out of that line of work. And there are awesome Christian ministries that I know personally, people who are part of them, whose goal is to reach out to women in the sex trade. Many of these women, of course, are economically disadvantaged in our own modern contexts and provide the means for them to get out of it. Very, very cool ministries that are happening with women in these lines of work. And, I mean, not only can they not become members of the covenant community, I mean, here we have Rahab in the lineage of Jesus. Does God honor Rahab's faith? Absolutely. She gets 3 shout-outs in the New Testament. That's more than a lot of people from the Old Testament get shout-outs from the New Testament. That's more than Ruth or Esther get shout-outs in the New Testament. They've got whole books, and they're honor in the Old. 3 times she's named by name. As part of the covenant community of faith. And she's a Canaanite. She's a prostitute. And yet God saves her. Why? Because she trusts in Israel's God. That's all there is to it. She sees him coming. She sees him as the Lord of heaven and earth. She sees what he's doing with his people, and she's like, forget this crap, I'm with them. Alone of all of her people. No one else in Jericho gets the memo. And you have to wonder, could other Jerichoites have gotten this same benefit? I mean, we have no reason to think they couldn't have. That if they all just, you know what, we're with you guys. We repent of the things we've done wrong, and we submit to Yahweh and his law, and we are with you. We have no reason to believe from this narrative that God wouldn't have spared them also. And none of them did. Sure. Sure. Interesting. Yeah, it talks about her father and brothers, and she provides for her family in a major way, doesn't she? Just get their whole lives handed to them. What does Rahab teach us about what makes us acceptable to God? Mm-hmm. Say it again. That we can be redeemed. Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't matter what sort of bad things you've ever done, if you have the trust that...
If at the moment of decision you say yes to Jesus, yep, you're in. And she has lived among Israel to this day. Boy, you better believe it. She still lives with Israel to this day, right? She's part of the redeemed. We'll get to meet this woman when we get to the new heavens and the new earth. Get to tell her story. Like, Rahab, tell us what happened. The narrative is kind of terse. Can you give us the juicy details? When you heard the trumpet sounding, were you nervous? When you heard the wall start to crack and groan, like, what were you thinking? Wouldn't you just love to hear her version of the story? Maybe this is her version of the story. Who knows? Maybe what's recorded is her own account, and that's what's become part of the narrative. I don't know. All we do know is that God honors her greatly. She doesn't just get saved. She gets incorporated into the people of God as a full member, and then on top of that, she becomes part of the lineage of the Messiah. And God often uses women in difficult spots from seedy backgrounds. A Moabitess, Ruth. I think Tamar is in the lineage. Bathsheba is in the lineage. Has a child out of wedlock. God grafts her in, right? The Messiah has come to save sinners. And he does that even in his own lineage. Yeah.
It seems important, too, that not only does God not shy away from all these things about her that kind of potentially mean that she's a servant, don't shy away. Even though, and then, and if she is a prostitute, like, they have access to, just kind of forms of her life. And they've just been instructed by God to slide these people. But from any indication that they hesitate to...
No, that's a good point. And how often does the church itself become a hindrance to those trying to make their way in? Because we can't let go of their pasts. And here we have God himself is willing to forget it all. I have removed my sins from them, their sins from them as far as the east is from the west. I will remember their sins no more, Isaiah the prophet. And sometimes the church becomes a barrier to people because we can't let go. But that doesn't stop God. Maybe that should humble us, call us to humility, call us to... pay attention to what God's doing in people's lives as best as we can discern it. Someone comes into our church seemingly from a seedy background. Why are you here? Has the Lord brought you here today? Come on in. Have a seat. Here's some food. Can we be that kind of church? Of course, it's easy in the abstract, right? I mean, it's not until you actually meet these people that you're like... It's always the moment of decision, right? When you meet them face to face. But let the story of Rahab case you to that. I think it's a great point. No one is irredeemable from God's point of view, and God's called us to be his agents in the proclamation of that good news. May we have the faithfulness of Joshua and his armies when they saw this woman's faith and they were like, that's what God wants, so yeah, come on in. If you're willing to submit to his law, you're great, you're with us. Didn't hesitate. Easily could have allowed prejudice to bias themselves against her, but they didn't. All right, we're out of time. I've actually finished on time today. Next week, we'll look at Hannah. I love the story of Hannah. Hannah's a wonderful precursor of the mother of our Lord in a very, very crucial way, textually. I love the way she puts Eli in his place. So we'll look at that next week.